Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
From WBUR in Boston, it's Here and Now. I'm Bill Delaney. Coming up, a Black Hawk down in near to Crete. We'll look at the vulnerability of the U.S. helicopter fleet in Iraq. Better news on the economy. Companies in the U.S. add thousands of new jobs for the third straight month. But what kind of jobs are they? The Bush administration's new savings plans. And a group of Black Bostonians use the internet to put some color into nightclubs where the clientele's mostly white.
We often joke when we go to friendly takeovers how the staff will look at you like, you know, that like there's something odd about you being there. So they'll ask you this, is there a conference in town?
These stories and a new movie and a book on Tupac Shakur coming up Here and Now. The news is first.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Ann Bozell. The nation's unemployment rate fell slightly in October to 6%. The Labor Department says payrolls grew by a better-than-expected 126,000 jobs. Analyst Hugh Johnson is with First Albany Corporation. He says the nation's job market might finally be turning around.
We've seen a decline in jobless claims, which is a leading indicator of employment, and now we see it show up in the actual numbers. Companies are now starting to open their purse strings up some and start to hire workers. So conditions are starting to get better, and it's starting to look like a real economic recovery.
There have now been three straight months of hiring gains, ending a six-month slump. Another U.S. helicopter has been shot down in Iraq, the second in less than a week. The U.S. military says an Army Black Hawk helicopter was downed near to Crete, killing six members of the 101st Airborne Division. Last Sunday, a larger Chinook helicopter was shot down near Fallujah, killing 16 Americans. NPR's Ivan Watson tells us the attacks may force some changes in the way the U.S. military operates in Iraq.
It basically shows that the aircraft cannot operate at will throughout this country, that they will perhaps have to be flying higher in the air and perhaps have to take some additional precautions when taking off and landing. The headquarters where this incident took place into Crete, there are a number of helicopters that fly in and out of that place. And according to the reports, according to servicemen I've spoken with, they could plainly see the wreckage of the helicopter, the smoke rising from that helicopter, from the headquarters itself, demonstrating that they can attack almost at any time, any place.
NPR's Ivan Watson speaking to us from Baghdad. An Air Force translator who was stationed at the Guantanamo Bay prison for terrorism suspects will go before a court-martial in the continuing investigation of possible espionage at the facility. Ed Thompson has that story.
Senior Airman Ahmed Al-Halabi faces 20 charges, including aiding the enemy and the possession of sensitive documents. The U.S. military alleges the translator gave classified information to people from Syria and Qatar about the detention facility at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. Al-Halabi is a naturalized U.S. citizen born in Syria. He faces the most serious charges among the three men who have been arrested for alleged security breaches at Guantanamo. A Muslim chaplain has been charged with two counts of mishandling classified information, and a civilian interpreter faces charges in connection with computer disk, which he was carrying, which contained classified information. All three men contend they are innocent. The date for Al-Halabi's court-martial has not been set. Air Force officials say the death penalty will not be sought in his case. For NPR News, I'm Ed Thompson.
Stocks are trading higher this hour. On Wall Street, the Dow is up 14 points to 98.71. The Nasdaq's up 8. The S&P is up 1. This is NPR News. In NPR's business update, a federal judge has shut down a pharmacy company that imports prescription drugs from Canada. The Tulsa, Oklahoma firm operates as RX Depot and RX of Canada. The judge ruled that it is violating a federal law that only allows manufacturers to bring drugs into the U.S. The order requires the company to close its 85 storefronts nationwide. Fast food giant McDonald's Corporation says its same-store sales were up in October. Chicago Public Radio's Ben Calhoun reports.
McDonald's Corporation says October sales at its restaurants open more than a year rose more than 8%. In the U.S., same-store sales rose 15%, and U.S. stores posted the highest monthly increase in more than 5 years. McDonald's, the world's largest restaurant company, says U.S. sales improved throughout all parts of its serving day. They say that's because of menu improvements like entree-sized salads and McGriddle's breakfast sandwiches. They also say extended hours and promotions like the Monopoly game helped increase sales. Same-store numbers in Europe rose 2.1%, with increased sales in France, Germany, and Britain. For NPR News, I'm Ben Calhoun in Chicago.
The Commerce Department says wholesale inventories rose in September as stocks of non-durable goods such as petroleum and groceries increased. The department says stocks of wholesale goods climbed 0.4%. That would be the sharpest rate of increase since March, and it's about four times as much as analysts had been expecting. I'm Ann Bozell, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting efforts to find and fight the causes of homelessness. On the web at melvilletrust.org.
I'm Bill Delaney. Robin Young is off today. It's Here and Now. An Army Black Hawk helicopter crashed Friday into a riverbank near Tikrit, Iraq, killing six U.S. soldiers. The U.S. military says the helicopter was likely hit by a rocket-propelled grenade. The downing brings to three the number of U.S. helicopters that have been brought down by insurgent fire in Iraq in the last 2 weeks. We're joined now by Sean McFate, a former Stinger missile platoon leader with the U.S. Army, who's now at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University. And welcome, Sean.
Hello.
Sean, the first helicopter brought down this week was a Chinook. This was a Black Hawk. What's the difference?
A Chinook is about twice the size of a Black Hawk. It's a large two-rotor helicopter that is big enough that you can drive a car into. It's much slower and makes an easier target.
Black Hawk is smaller and a lot faster. It's also heavily armored. It has defensive systems, right?
It does. Both helicopters have M60 gunners on them. Usually the Black Hawk crew is trained to fly into hostile areas more than a Chinook. So it's likely that the Black Hawk crew had more training in terms of defense.
Now, we do read that the Black Hawk sent off flares. Why would it have done that? And what would that tell you about this particular attack?
Well, flares basically try to deflect a heat-seeking missile. There are several types of what we call manned portable air defenses, which are like Stinger missiles or Soviet SA-7. These are shoulder-fired missiles that home in on a hot engine of an aircraft. So If the aircraft is sending off flares, it means that, A, the pilot has spotted a smoke trail, B, believes it might be a man pad, and then disperse the flares.
And yet this apparently, and this is reportedly, the Black Hawk was brought down by a rocket-propelled grenade. That's not all that easy to do, is it?
No, it really would take a lucky shot. The difference between a man pad and an RPG is that RPGs are not, they don't have any sort of guidance system. They don't hone in on a hot engine. However, they both leave a similar type of smoke trail. They look very similar to a pilot. So if a pilot sees a smoke trail, he's just going to, or she's just going to pop flares.
Sean, what does this do to the pilots of these helicopters, to their psychology as they fly constantly around Iraq, now feeling more vulnerable than ever to this relatively low-tech but deadly attack?
Well, obviously it's going to do several things to the morale, not just to the pilots, but everybody flies in helicopters, which is basically everybody, every soldier in the coalition forces. It's also going to change the way the U.S. military conducts operations in Iraq. It's probably going to make helicopters avoid urban areas, which is a problem. It's going to make them fly at night because it's much harder to shoot and get a lucky shot at a helicopter at night if you're an RPG operator. And three, it's going to require a lot more Apache gunship helicopter escorts, and there just aren't that many Apaches out there.
Sean McFaith of the Kennedy School of Government. Thanks a lot, Sean.
Thank you.
The Labor Department is reporting that 126,000 new jobs materialized last month, dropping the unemployment rate to 6%. It was the third straight month companies added thousands of new jobs. Leonard Lardario is a professor of economics at the University of Rhode Island. He joins me on the line from his home in Wakefield, Rhode Island, and welcome, Leonard.
Thank you very much for having me.
Professor, your thoughts this morning when you heard about the good news in the economy?
Well, the good news was not only for October's employment, but for the prior month, there was a substantial upward revision. So what we've seen is that a very large number of jobs compared to what we thought are being created. And what's actually happening in the economy is that in a post-manufacturing economy, it appears that with lags of data, with different patterns of things, things are always darkest at the dawn. So we're actually doing better than statistics indicate we are. Then with revisions, oh, we're actually doing better. So this was a very, very good report.
A post-manufacturing economy. What kind of jobs then are these?
Well, there are jobs pretty much throughout the economy. Manufacturing actually went down a little bit, but if you look at retail, trade added about 30,000 jobs, professional services added some, education, health services, and also temporary help services, which pretty much are a leading indicator of what's going to happen with full-time employment. So it's not just one or two areas. It's not something like just government. It was fairly widely spread.
So we all know how many millions of jobs have been lost in the manufacturing sector. You call it a post-manufacturing economy. So is what's happening here on the whole new sectors of the economy starting to generate jobs?
Well, what you look at is that manufacturing employment is going down, but that doesn't mean that manufacturing production is going down. That's what the rapid productivity growth is saying, that output's going up with fewer people. And so not all the jobs are lost to overseas. What you have is a lot of jobs are lost to new technology. So we are not creating as many jobs, but you know, in the manufacturing sector, but the service sector becomes the primary provider of jobs, and things like retail trade or wholesale trade or professional services, those kinds of things take over. And so the point is you can still generate a lot of income in manufacturing, but you're not going to have the kind of job growth.
And these are permanent jobs. You alluded earlier to some of these jobs being temporary, but on the whole, are we talking about jobs people are going to be able to keep for a long time?
Not yet. We're still seeing some of these jobs, if you look at the job growth in retailing, it's not likely, and we don't have statistics exactly, that a lot of those are full-time with fringe benefits. Some of those might actually be part-time now. But if things start to pick up on a more sustained basis, you're going to see more and more full-time sustainable jobs created.
Very, very good economic news, including that searing 7.2% growth in the third quarter. It all sounds good, but there's a shadow on it, isn't there? The deficit approaching $400 billion. Does the deficit matter?
The deficit matters, but not necessarily its dollar value. And that's a common mistake that people make. Because what you have to look at is the deficit relative to our ability to pay it. And actually, the numbers now, although, I mean, there certainly are some problems with the deficit rising fairly rapidly, but as a percentage of GDP, this is well below the numbers we posted in the early 1980s. And also, as the economy improves, since we have an income tax system, you're going to find that tax revenue is going to perk up. And this will be very good news at the state level, because states have really had a lot of difficulties, and states have had to balance their budget, 48 of the 50, which have counteracted some of the fiscal policy. As states try to balance, they raise taxes or cut spending, they're offsetting federal policy. As the economy kicks in and as states get better, that's going to even give more push as we go forward with the national economy and the fiscal policy. And so we might have timed this fairly well.
Leonard Lardario is a professor of economics at the University of Rhode Island. Professor, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Almost everyone agrees that Americans need to save more money, but Republicans and Democrats have very different ideas about how to make that happen. the Bush administration is planning to create two new tax-exempt accounts that would allow American families to sock away up to $15,000 tax-free each year. According to the Wall Street Journal, the new accounts may be central to the administration's election year strategy. Several of the Democratic presidential candidates have proposed their own savings plans, plans targeted directly at low-income Americans. Wall Street Journal staff writer John McKinnon has been reporting on the savings plans. He joins us now. Hi, John.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks, and thanks for joining us. John, let's talk about the Bush administration plan first. How would it work?
Well, the administration wants to allow people to contribute up to $7,500 per individual to two different accounts. One is a lifetime savings account that would allow people to save for basically whatever they want, a house, a car, a big vacation, and withdraw the money tax-free whenever they need it. Mm-hmm. And the second account would be more like the existing IRAs, but would allow people, obviously, to put away more money than they can currently put away for their retirements.
So how is this different than the way so many of us are saving for old age, 401ks?
401ks, in essence, would continue under the plan that the administration is looking at.
But there is some thought, isn't there, that if mm-hmm. these plans become too common, that could discourage some particularly small businesses, as I understand it, from offering 401k plans.
Well, that's right. But there are lots of people who don't have access to a retirement savings plan at work.
Mm-hmm.
And in part, the administration's plan is built on that lack of coverage for lots and lots of workers in the U.S. So essentially, they're trying to give those folks a way to save a lot of money as well. But there is a concern, you're right, that beefing up what are referred to as individual savings accounts will have the effect of kind of undermining employer-based savings plans, because a lot of small business owners might think, well, why do I really need to create a program for my workers when I can use one of these individual accounts and save as much as I need?
Another problem with these accounts might be, John, don't you think that, well, you got to have $15,000 to put away, right?
Well, you know, to get the maximum benefit, you do have to have a lot of extra cash lying around, and unfortunately, not all of us have that much money.
Now, the Democrats have targeted those lower-income workers. How do their savings incentive plans differ from the Bush plan?
Well, it's interesting. Their plans are still being developed, and several of the candidates, I think, are just beginning to turn to this issue, but Democrats are concerned that only about a fifth of households that make less than $20,000 have any money socked away at all. So they're trying to come up with different ways to really get people at the lower rungs of the economic ladder involved.
Yeah, yeah. Well, just to finish up, John, big deficits out there. These savings plans could reduce tax revenues, right? Is that a good idea?
In the short run, these plans actually don't look that bad, and by the short run, I mean over the next 10 years or so,
mm-hmm.
Because the Bush administration's plan would basically do away with the upfront deduction that you get for a traditional IRA. But over the long run, the tax breaks that the Bush administration plan would create at the back end when you withdraw the money and get it tax-free would start to cost the government a ton of money, basically.
John McKinnon, Wall Street Journal staff writer, joined us from Washington. Thanks a lot, John.
Sure.
As always, we welcome your thoughts on our program. Send us an email at letters@here-now.org. That's letters@HERE-NOW.ORG. Or you can call our listener line and leave us a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Please tell us how to pronounce your name and tell us the town you're from. Well, just ahead, a group of black Bostonians add some color to a nightlife that can get pretty monochromatic. And later in the show, why are the Reagan years not ready for prime time? There's more coming up here and now. I'm Bill Delaney. It's Here and Now. Like in a lot of places, a typical bar in Boston will not typically be all that racially diverse. But recently, that's been changing. A black professional named Reggie Cummings started emailing friends and coworkers about bars he felt could use a little color. He'd set a day and time for people on his email list to show up at a given bar. It's all quite good-natured. In fact, Cummings calls the events friendly takeovers. Here and Now producer Lindsay Crudell went along to one friendly takeover at a swanky Boston night spot.
Hi, I'm Reggie Cummings. I am from Boston, Massachusetts. I am the co-founder of The Inner Circle, which is an organization dedicated to promoting and supporting networking amongst black professionals in Boston.
So you're here tonight for a friendly takeover. Tell me about that.
Boston does not have a very good reputation amongst black professional people across the country. Now, the reason being, you know, the history, the whole Charles Stewart thing, the whole busing thing from the 70s. A lot of black professionals come to Boston for school or work, whatever, and they don't get the same warm feeling, the same kind of reception, the same kinds of opportunities that they have in other cities. The black professional community in Boston is very segmented, fractured, disconnected. And we decide to do something about it. Typically, if a place holds 100 people, if you walk in, if you're a regular customer there, and you walk in and you're used to seeing 50 or 60 white people, and you walk in and you see 30 or 40 white people and 60 black people, you know, you're going to have a response, and your response is going to range from, and I've heard this literally, what is it, black night? To, wow, this is really cool, I'm going to come hang out anyway. And, you know, as you see, some of our people are sort of intermingling with the regular customers, and it feels good. It feels right. You know, everybody loves it. It's really cool.
People are definitely starting to file in. What do you see now looking over at the bar?
There are more of our people here than the regular customers, so I guess the whole takeover notion is working.
Do you notice anything different about the people who are here tonight?
When you said, what's different about this bar, I looked around and I said, oh, there's a lot of black people here tonight. I noticed that. I did.
And what are your thoughts about that? Do you feel like it's usually this diverse?
I've only been here one other time, and I didn't remember it being like this.
Yeah, but now it seems less diverse, right?
Yeah, no, exactly.
That's a good actually point. Increasing diversity.
It'd be empty otherwise. It'd be him and I sitting there.
I am Demetrius Quarles. If you are a minority living in the city of Boston, there are not many venues for one to get together and being able to, I guess, bond and share stories and be in a comfortable atmosphere. For lack of a better place, they primarily stay home.
What do you find yourself seeing when you go out that makes you feel like it's not really the place for you?
For me, it's probably a feel I have. It's not necessary that it has to be. You have to be surrounded by other African Americans, but it's just about how the feel is, and then how, once again, the other patrons in the facility may interact or intermingle with me.
Hi, my name is Candace Burns. Being from Boston, you know, you have the opportunity to just go around to so many different bars, and in many cases, you're really the only person of color. You know, it's nice to just get some exposure, not only to bring us into a place, but for the owners of the establishments to know that there's a crowd out here, diverse crowd that would support their business if they welcome and open the doors to us. Maybe people just don't know about these establishments. Maybe they're not advertised in some of the local papers that, you know, more people of color read, the Bay State Fan or what have you. You know, I think there's a number of different reasons.
What's your name?
Chris Lafrano.
You're a bartender?
Yes.
Did you notice anything different about the bar tonight?
Normally we have definitely different clientele, but we serve all types of people in Boston.
So when you say different, though, what do you mean?
Well, normally we have a lot of members and investors, and normally they're Caucasian, but it's a cosmopolitan city, and everyone's certainly welcome to come in here. Not only is it busier, but also you want to work a little bit harder because yeah, obviously the people in here tonight are a little bit different, but at the same time, they're also new customers. So you want to give them a little bit more, make them come back.
My name is Michael Curry.
Hello, my name is Kahari Porter.
You guys are both here for the friendly takeover. What are your thoughts tonight?
We often joke when we go to friendly takeovers how the staff will look at you like, you know, that like there's something odd about you being there. So they'll ask you this, is there a conference in town?
I mean, because historically speaking, I mean, us as urban professionals, we don't really stay downtown and socialize after we work together with, you know, our other counterparts or what have you.
Why not?
Because certain venues do not cater, or we felt that they didn't cater to, I mean, I don't know, our lifestyle, culture, what have you. But now, as certain music is getting popular and ideas and minds are becoming open, we're starting to see that the guard is changing, so to speak.
Do you think there's going to be a time when the bars are just going to look like this?
I think that's a difficult thing. I think it's a matter of us changing it. Even if there's some attitude, some reluctance to the change, or some hesitance to accommodate the change, in the end, you know, money talks. And, you know, you bring a friendly demeanor into a place and money, eventually the venue's receptive to it. So I think it could change. It's going to take a little bit of time, though.
What do you see here tonight? Look around.
I see beautiful people, all walks of life.
Our visit to a friendly takeover was produced by Lindsay Crudell. Next week on Here and Now, investors are taking billions of dollars out of Putnam Investments. Are other mutual funds reaping the benefit? And we'll look at the case of a South Carolina school cafeteria worker who's retired and is now suing her former employer for years of unpaid overtime. That's next week.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney. It's Here and Now. Coming up, Network TV spikes a miniseries about the Reagan years. Critics say it was an accurate portrayal of the former first couple.
I can't redecorate the White House for $50,000. I need a million, at least.
And a new movie, Tupac Resurrection, looks at the life of hip-hop star Tupac Shakur in his own words.
I have not brought thug life to America. I didn't create thug life. I diagnosed it.
These stories coming up, Here and Now.
I'm Dolores Handy. Six U.S. soldiers were killed today when an Army Black Hawk helicopter crashed near Saddam Hussein's hometown of Tikrit. Officials say it was probably hit by a rocket-propelled grenade. Two more Americans were killed in separate attacks in the northern city of Mosul. The deaths brought to 31 the number of U.S. soldiers killed in the first week of November, the deadliest week since the fall of Baghdad in April. Former U.S. prisoner of war in Iraq, Jessica Lynch, is criticizing the way she was used by the military. In an interview with ABC's Diane Sawyer, Lynch accused the military of using her capture and dramatic nighttime rescue to sway public support for the war in Iraq. Dramatic video of U.S. commandos whisking the former Army supply clerk from a hospital to a waiting chopper on April 1st helps cement Lynch's image as a hero. In a setback for U.S. planning in Iraq, the government of Turkey said today it will not be sending troops to Iraq to relieve U.S. forces, this following opposition to such a deployment from Iraqi officials. Turkish lawmakers voted just last month to allow the deployment, but said they would not send the troops unless the Iraqi Governing Council invited them. Israeli troops killed three Palestinian gunmen and a 10-year-old boy in the Gaza Strip today, according to security officials. Hospital officials say the boy was shot east of Gaza City as he was trapping birds near the border fence with Israel. The child's 12-year-old companion was wounded in the leg. The Israeli army says soldiers spotted three people in a restricted area along the fence where militants have tried to infiltrate. Jurors in the trial of Washington, D.C. area sniper shooting suspect John Allen Muhammad are taking a field trip. Over the objections of the defense, the judge is allowing the jury to be taken to city jail in Virginia to see the car police believe Muhammad and fellow suspect Lee Malvo used in last year's shooting spree. Jurors have already seen a tape showing how prosecutors believe the car's trunk served as a shooting platform during the attacks, which claimed the lives of 10 people. The nation's unemployment rate dropped a tenth of a percent last month to 6%. In new evidence of an improving economy, the Labor Department reports that for the third straight month, businesses added new jobs. Payrolls grew by 126,000 jobs in October, much more than economists had predicted. On Wall Street at midday, stocks are mixed. The Dow is up, the Nasdaq is up, the S&P is down a fraction. You're listening to Here and Now.
I'm Bill Delaney. Robin Young is away. It's Here and Now. A former president in the news this week following the CBS television network's decision to pull the plug on its miniseries, The Reagans. Conservative complaints drove the decision, angering many media watchers and liberals. Even CBS's own David Letterman weighed in. He said one of the top 10 inaccuracies about the movie was all the Matrix-style kung fu. Let's listen to a bit of the movie.
This White House, women will not wear pants of any kind.
How do you like those Iranians releasing the hostages on my inauguration day?
I can't redecorate the White House for 50,000. I need a million, at least.
Okay, there really was no kung fu. But what's real and what's not about Ron and Nancy Reagan and who gets to decide? The question for our editorial roundtable this morning. Joining us on the line are Nolan Finley, editorial page editor of the Detroit News in Detroit, Michigan. Hi, Nolan.
Hey, Bill.
And Alicia Blaisdell-Bannon, managing editor of the Cape Cod Times in Hyannis, Massachusetts. Hi, Alicia.
Hi, Bill.
Welcome to you both. Alicia, the New York Times called CBS's decision a Soviet-style chill.
we're talking about
a miniseries here. What do you make of that?
Well, I think the New York Times probably has better things to do, but I can't disagree with them too much.
Mm-hmm.
We, from our perspective right here in Kennedy Land, we're pretty stunned that there are groups out there that can get biopics of ex-presidents canceled at the drop of a hat. It seems like a lot of lather over not much.
You know, listen to this quote. NPR quoting former Reagan advisor Ed Rollins. He said, "It's not a good time to piss off Republicans."
Well, that's true.
It's never a good time to piss off Republicans.
Well,
it's kind of ironic, I think, that the Kennedy movies have all focused on his love life as opposed to his politics, and the Republicans would like the Reagan movie to focus on his politics and not his love life.
Well, Nolan, it did start off at ABC as a love story and then transmogrified somehow at CBS into a much more politically slanted, some say, biopic.
Well, this is the difference between the Kennedys and the unflattering movies about Jefferson and Eisenhower and all sorts of other ex-president is that Ronald Reagan's still alive, and we seem to forget that. And, you know, this apparently was a highly fictionalized, highly unflattering movie with an agenda. Now, should CBS have gone ahead and shown it? I think they should have made the decision the same way they make the decision about every movie. Not every movie that gets produced gets aired, and maybe this just they took a look at it and decided it just wasn't a very good movie.
Oh, do you really think so, or do you think it was politics?
Well, I mean, certainly the publicity wouldn't have hurt the viewership. I don't, you know, I assume they did bow to pressure, but you can imagine the uproar if someone were to do a movie focusing on Martin Luther King Jr.'s love life.
Well, we'll see if there's an uproar when A&E does its movie on Hillary Clinton that I guess is scheduled for next year. I can't imagine that that's going to be totally flattering either.
No.
Glad you brought that up, Alicia. The actress slated to play Hillary at the moment is Sharon Stone.
Sharon Stone, absolutely. There you go.
Now, well, I think Hillary ought to be highly flattered.
Well, we'll see. We'll see. I think it's kind of disingenuous, though, for CBS to suggest that in that kind of Casablanca, I'm shocked that there's gambling in this casino way, to suggest that they only now looked at this movie and kind of hit themselves upside the head and said, wow, this really isn't a love story.
So, Alicia, do you think they should have pulled it under pressure from conservatives?
No, I never think anything should be pulled under pressure from conservatives. I don't think anything should be. I mean, you know, is this one that I would have watched? Probably not.
Now, suppose there's a biopic, I'm told maybe is the correct way to say it, about Hillary Clinton. And suppose, Alicia, you feel it's very unfair to Hillary Clinton.
No, I won't watch it.
You won't watch it, but you wouldn't argue that it should be pulled?
Nope. You know, I don't think that all these sort of biopic movies, whether they're about presidents or first ladies or GIs or kidnapped girls or whatever, are telling the whole story. I just think it's my choice whether to turn them off or not.
I don't know. I object in general to these instant fictional histories. I think the history of the country is a very precious thing, and it should be handled with a lot more respect and perhaps allowed to age a bit before it's rushed onto the air.
I agree, but I don't think that groups should be able to dictate that they're taken off the air.
Judy Davis, who was going to play Nancy Reagan, told a New York Times interviewer that the film could, she felt, offset, she said, quote, the sort of ugly specter of patriotism in America today.
Oh, no, patriotism.
Yeah.
Wait a minute, Judy Davis isn't an American citizen, is she?
No, she's not. But what do you make of an actress going into a film like this with kind of an agenda, it sounds like.
Well, could she have had any greater an agenda than James Brolin, for goodness sake?
No, James Brolin, married to Barbara Streisand, who, of course, is very unhappy that the Reagan miniseries was pulled.
So now, you know, Americans are not only getting their history from Hollywood, but their politics from Hollywood. We are in sorry shape.
Well, we're getting our politicians from Hollywood, too, for that matter,
right.
So I guess it's okay.
You know, we're not a nation that reads nearly as much, to say the least, as it watches television. So audiences do tend to get their pictures of who people are from television. That's naturally one import of the Reagan miniseries. This weekend, two major miniseries competing with each other directly at 9 o'clock in the evening Eastern time. One on Elizabeth Smart, the kidnapped girl in Utah, and one on Private Jessica Lynch. Any thoughts, Alicia, on that?
I think I'm with Nolan on this. I think that these sort of history happens, something happens, and then 2 months later we've got a movie, more or less, in the works, is a goofy, nutty way to present news. I think it's, but I think we've blurred all these lines now, unfortunately. Like, K Street or whatever the program is on HBO that's sort of half real and half pretend. And half, I think these lines are becoming – I'm amazed that anybody can actually tell what is really happening if they were just looking at television or the movies.
Nolan, what does it say about media that I would bet that, I don't know, 10 years ago maybe – there might be a CBS Reports or an NBC white paper on what happened to Jessica Lynch. Now we get a miniseries.
Life is one big reality show, and these trauma dramas, you know, I just find appalling. I mean, here you had a little girl, a young girl, traumatized, brutalized, abused. And, you know, her parents think, hey, wouldn't it be a great idea to make a movie from all of this? And I read in one of the news magazines that she wanted to play herself.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if we have, you know, just no concept of anymore of what's personal business and what isn't. I think, you know, it reflects, you know, the Oprahization of society, that all of our business has to be laid bare and in the most, in the most appalling way.
What's real and what's not in the miniseries. We were joined today by our editorial roundtable to discuss all that. Alicia Blaisdell-Bannon is managing editor of the Cape Cod Times in Hyannis, Massachusetts, and Nolan Findlay is editorial page editor of the Detroit News in Detroit, Michigan. Thank you both.
Thanks, Bill.
Thank you, Bill.
Still to come, the late Tupac Shakur in a new documentary. You're listening to Here and Now. Well, we just mentioned the TV movie about Private Jessica Lynch this Sunday night. There will also be a Tuesday interview with Diane Sawyer. Lynch will be on the cover of Time magazine, and her book, I Am a Soldier Too, will be released. Lynch's story is compelling, though the facts can get a bit murky. Well, one of the people at the center of it all now, with unique access to the facts, is Mohammed al-Rakif. He's the Iraqi lawyer who tipped off U.S. soldiers about where Private Lynch was, prompting her rescue. And welcome, Mohammed.
Welcome. Thank you very much.
Mohammed, thank you so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
Thank you. You've won political asylum in the United States now, Mohammed, and you've written a book about your story. It's called Because Each Life is Precious. What does the title mean?
This means every life is special without any nationality. We, all of us, are children of one God. And if I see anybody in danger, I have to help him.
When did you first see Private Lynch?
I went to visit my wife. She worked in the Saddam Hospital as a nurse there. And my story with Jessica started when I heard about her. In this moment, and my wife and my sister-in-law, Hamida, she works as a doctor there, helped me to go inside her room, and I saw what I saw.
Then you knew as soon as you saw this wounded young American girl that you had to do something about it, and you went and you found U.S. soldiers.
Exactly.
You put yourself at considerable risk doing that.
Yes, I agree with you. It was a very tough decision. And very hard because, you know, this situation, this moment was the war and the bombs everywhere. And also the Fidayus Saddam and the security Saddam, if they know about what I did, they will kill me and kill my family.
Yeah. It must be somewhat strange for you now that Jessica Lynch says she doesn't remember you, nor does she remember what you said happened to her. Being slapped by the Iraqis in the hospital. How does all that make you feel?
Do you know, believe me, I answer to you and I answer to God. This is not my concern. Do you know, it's so important to me. She is safety and she is at home and she is happy. I think she is had very difficult time. I believe she had very difficult time because I saw what happened with her. But I think she is maybe can't remember what happened with her.
You went to her hometown, Palestine, West Virginia.
Yes.
They laid out a banquet for you, including ham, and during Ramadan, when, of course, Muslims are fasting all day.
Exactly, yeah.
I guess it was a well-meant gesture, but you must have been a bit surprised.
Yeah. The people in West Virginia, I loved West Virginia, very special to me. They very kind, and I love everybody there. But I met her cousin. I was very glad. Thank you.
Do you hope to meet Jessica Lynch?
Yes, I hope meet her because I want to tell her thank you for what she did and her friends, all the American troops, for give us the freedom.
Mohammed Al-Rahif, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Oh, thank you, sir. It's my pleasure.
Mohammed Al-Rahif is the author of Because Each Life is Precious, his account of helping rescue Private Jessica Lynch. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Bill Delaney. It's Here and Now. Although hip-hop artist Tupac Shakur was only 25 when he was shot to death in Las Vegas in September of 1996, his career had already been marked by great success and controversy. Now his story is being told in a new authorized documentary film produced by his mother, Afeni Shakur, much of it told in his own words.
I had a prophecy about my death. That's why I like to go in the studio and do 3 songs a day, get things ready.
We don't have time or the luxury to spend all this time doing one song. We don't have it.
So this is my story, a story about ambition, violence, redemption, and love.
The movie opens nationwide next week, and here with a review is Here and Now film critic Eric Schaefer. Welcome, Eric.
Hi, Bill.
Tupac Shakur generated a lot of controversy in his short lifetime. This is an authorized biography. Is it a sanitized picture of this man?
No, it's not really a sanitized picture. And to be quite frank, I was a little surprised by that. Since this was produced or executive produced by his mother, it's clear that she was a tremendous influence on Tupac.
My mother was a Black Panther, and she was really involved in the movement.
Power! Power! Power to the people!
She had a high position in the Panther Party, which was like unheard of, because of course there was sexism, even in the Panthers.
You always was the Black queen, mama.
The person that supported me the most was my mother. My mom's just a bomb, you know, world's best mom.
She had this position of power in the Black Panthers, but then later on, fell on extremely hard times. She became addicted to crack cocaine. This is essentially told entirely in Tupac's own words. He narrates the film. It's been cobbled together from, various interviews that he did while he was alive. So you might expect to get a rather one-sided view of things, but he does manage to keep it open, to all different sides. On the one hand, he was obviously extremely bright. He was very charismatic and talented. And on the other hand, he was, rather egocentric, and we see that displayed in the film. He also displayed remarkably bad judgment at times.
None of those qualities unique to pop stars in their mid-20s, of course.
Not. And one of the things, too, about the narration is that it has a real haunting quality, the fact that he is narrating this film himself and that he did seem to have these premonitions about his death. It gives it a really sort of unusual quality.
I always felt like I'd be shot.
somebody try to do me some harm because a lot of people don't like me.
It's a poignant and powerful story. What about the music, though? Does it reveal the performer as well as the man?
Well, one of the things that's interesting is there's not nearly as much of Tupac's music in this film as you might expect. Hmm. You know, it is there, but you also hear a lot of music from people who influenced him. You hear music from Kate Bush and Don McLean, people who you would not necessarily think of as being an influence on a rap star.
Not
but,
at all.
But you hear them in there.
Eric, for somebody coming to this film with a great interest in Tupac Shakur, I'm sure it's compelling because he was such a compelling guy and artist. What about somebody coming to the film, though, who didn't know much about him and may not be much of a rap music fan necessarily?
Well, I think that both parties are going to be surprised. People who are Tupac fans are probably going to find that they're learning things about him that they did not know. You know, that he took ballet classes when he was in the Performing Arts High School in Baltimore and so on. So I think they'll be surprised by some of this information. But people who don't know much about rap music, I think, are going to be pleasantly surprised as well. They're going to see that this person was really multifaceted and multi-talented. You know, in addition to the music, he was also something of a budding actor, and it appeared in a couple of movies. So I think that folks are going to be pleasantly surprised by the picture that they get of him and of his life.
The film is Tupac Resurrection. Here and Now film critic Eric Schaefer joined us to review it. It opens in theaters next Friday. Thanks, Eric.
You bet, Bill.
So back at the time, I never thought I'd see a face. Ain't a woman alive that could take my mama's place. Suspended from school.
Dear Mama, Tupac Shakur's tribute to his mother, Afeni Shakur. It's but one of the songs used in a course on the life and the lyrics of the hip-hop star taught at the University of Pennsylvania by Professor Michael Eric Dyson. Professor Dyson joins us on the line now, and welcome, Professor.
Hi, how are you?
Michael, for someone who doesn't know his work at all, could you summarize in a concise way what Tupac was saying?
Well, he was saying that it's hurtful and painful to be a young, poor person in this society who was also black and male, that those difficulties must be fought by lyrical integrity and by bearing witness as loudly as one could against the silence to which young black people had been consigned. And finally, he was an articulate spokesperson for all young people who rebel against orthodoxies that entrap them. He was for the freedom of expression to explore one's own artistic gift in light of the social suffering that one endured as a way of hollering against it.
He was a brilliant performer, Michael. He was also a guy who was arrested several times for assault, including time spent in prison for sexual assault. Now, is that a guy you should be teaching about at an Ivy League university or anywhere else?
Sure, we teach about those kind of people all the time. That's what the point of college is, to interrogate, to ask questions of, and to think critically outside the box of politically correct viewpoints that says you shouldn't do things like that.
Yeah.
More important, he should be taught because his lyrics, his insight, his trouble, his contradictions, he was both great in one sense and also troubled in another sense, should be used as a means to investigate how all artists deal with these issues.
Let's look at one of his songs, Unconditional Love, it's called.
One day I hope to make it a player in this game. Mama, don't cry, long as we try, maybe things change. Perhaps it's just a fantasy, a life where we don't need no welfare. Where's she with our own family? Maybe it's me that caused it, the fighting and the hurting in my room crying, cause I didn't want to be a burden. Watch mama open up her arms to hug me, and I ain't worried about a damn thing.
Well, it's a song where Tupac is talking about his own relationships, his own struggle with fear, with not knowing God's plan for his life, but insisting that the unconditional love that he both experiences and expresses is the fundamental bedrock fact of our existence and the only reason for us to remain alive. And he struggles with the pain and suffering he endures at the same time speaking about that love as the cure for any problems one might have.
One more, Me Against the World.
Well, Me Against the World is about a young solo figure, as it were, pitting his own intelligence, his own spirit, his own power as a young black man who is troubled, but who's also stigmatized in the society against the world that refuses to see his intelligence, his integrity, or his work. And Tupac represented so much of that spirit in many of his lyrics.
Don't trust strangers, put one in the chamber whenever I'm feeling this anger. Don't want to make excuses, because this is how it is. What's the use unless we're shooting? No one notices the youth. It's just me against the world, baby.
Your class on them at Penn is very popular. Do white students take away something different than black students take away from the course?
Well, not by skin color coding or not by pigment, no. I mean, you can be as deep into Tupac as anybody and be a young white person and be offended by him and be black. An open mind will leave you with an impression that this was a deeply disturbed, highly gifted, profoundly articulate young man who has something that all people should listen to.
He's one of these artists that gets so deep into people's heads and hearts that there are actually many who believe he's still alive, right?
No doubt. Tupac is one of the first figures to join the pantheon of those who have a posthumous presence, by which I mean people like JFK or Marilyn Monroe or Elvis Presley. But usually it's a white icon. Now it's a black icon. Tupac is really the first figure to have survived death in the sense that people believe he's still alive on an island somewhere in Cuba. I wish that were true, but I think that part of that means that young people don't realize that bullets bring death and that tragedy can end up by snuffing out prematurely a gifted life.
Michael Eric Dyson, I wish we had a little more time. It's an amazing and complex subject. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Michael Eric Dyson is a professor at the University of Pennsylvania and author of the book, Holler If You Hear Me, Searching for Tupac Shakur.
When I was young, me and my mama had beef, 17 years old, kicked out on the streets. Though back at the time, I never thought I'd see a...
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Bill Delaney. Get into your radio and join us again, Here and Now.
The big boys breaking all the rules. Shed tears with my baby sister. Over the years, we was poor than other little kids. And even though we had different daddies, the same drama when things went wrong, we blame mama. I reminisce on the stress I caused. It was hell, hugging on my mama from a jail cell.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney. Join me next time for the news in these stories, Here and Now. Investors are taking billions out of Putnam Investments. Are other funds reaping the benefit? And a retired school cafeteria worker in South Carolina is suing for years of unpaid overtime. That's Public Radio's Midday News Magazine, Here and Now.